Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is the 31st President of the United States, the Honorable Herbert Hoover. Tomorrow, Mr. Hoover celebrates his 85th birthday, and a legion of friends will celebrate with him. His contribution to the welfare of his fellow man occupy a long and important chapter in world history. But one contribution is written deep in the hearts and minds of men, women, and children all over the world. The role he played after two world wars in saving them from starvation and disease. Although Mr. Hoover has a long and fruitful life to look back upon, his thoughts are on the present and to the future. He has completed the first volume of a book series to be titled An American Epic. He has started the second volume and is planning the rest. His daily workload is enough to keep six secretaries busy full time. Now seated around the press table ready to interview Mr. Hoover are Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications, Bob Considine of the Hearst Newspapers, Chet Huntley of NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak, a regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mr. Hoover, if you're ready, sir, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Hoover, as you must know, the number one question in the minds of the American people today is the coming visit of Mr. Khrushchev. What possible hope can the free world get from that visit?
Mr. Spivak, on this occasion, I want to slightly alter the rules of this session because I want to be perfectly precise, and I have a little script that'll just take 2 minutes. And after that, we'll do the usual ad-lib job.
That's all right.
The Soviet premier on this visit could bring the greatest, most generous gift which mankind has received in 1,000 years. He could interpret his oft-repeated statement as to peaceful coexistence as eliminating all international demands, all warnings, all threats, all conspiracies against free people. He could, to make peaceful coexistence effective, agree to cooperate in the League of Nations and upon the abolition of nuclear warfare, accompanied by a subsequent sessions on disarmament in general. And all of this would require international inspections as a guarantee for which we should be willing to submit also. All the people of the world would have, after this 40 years of death and destruction and famine and pestilence, want peace. Peace would give civilization a greater impulse forward than we have seen in 2 centuries. It would end the world's problems of hunger and poverty. Thus it is Mr. Khrushchev's opportunity to win immortality among the leaders of all men. But this is unlikely to be the result of this visit. The tactics of the communists may change, but their determination to dominate the world continues. Without that, the communists would be fade away at every point. However, there are hopeful possibilities out of this visit. They may be able to lessen the tensions in the world and maybe tide us over for a period in which there may be hopes of greater steps in peace. That is our hope, and would be helpful to a distrustful and disrupted mankind. We may be assured that the president will not compromise or appease with evil forces in this world. He's not that kind of a man. And our experience with Soviet fidelity to promises is a little disappointing. We must not be lulled into any complacency. We must be alert and armed to the teeth. The American people should convey their traditional courtesy to a leader of another government when he visits us. And we may hope that with his visit, he will realize that the real power of the American people is not their economic or military strength. The power of our people is in our religious beliefs, our devotion to freedom, and the ideals which sprang up on this continent five centuries ago.
Mr. Hoover, there's always danger of applying the lessons of one period to another period. But you were one of those who urged President Woodrow Wilson not to go to Paris and not to engage in personal negotiations. Do you see any lesson that Mr. Eisenhower can take from that past?
Well, I think the circumstances may entirely differ. I urged the president not to go for two reasons. The one is that a president of the United States has no equal position of authority with the prime ministers with whom he must sit. He cannot control his legislative body. They can, being the head of their legislative bodies, can exert that control. The second reason was that many of us believed that his voice from the White House would be more thunderous and more effective than in a council room. Well, it may not, none of that may apply at the present time, so I wouldn't want to offer it as an objection to the president's proposals.
Mr. Hoover, one more question along that line. President Eisenhower has said in the past that in dealing with the Soviet Union, we are interested in deeds, not words. Now, what do you think should be the minimum of deeds before the world can really relax?
Well, I tried to outline that here. I think the minimum step is, as I said, stop threats, stop all this conspiracy, stop all attempts to direct and order the rest of the world about, would be the very minimum that we could ask for.
Mr. Huntley.
Mr. President, you certainly demonstrated a conviction that the experience of former presidents should be utilized by the nation. But I wonder if you would recommend or propose any formal or constitutional position for past presidents. For example, I think ex officio roles in the Senate have been suggested, and cabinet posts and so on.
That subject's been under discussion for a good many years. And at one time, an investigation was made as to what would be necessary to establish a former president in the Senate. And it was found that it could be done by statutory law if he had no vote. And most ex-presidents would be glad to join the Senate without a vote.
Well, now, in all your services to the nation, in war and in peace, is there any one of which you are most proud?
Well, I should think the taking it all together, the various relief operations which I directed over a period, stretched over a period of nearly 40 years.
The relief operations.
I should think so.
And what about the commission to reorganize the executive branch of the government?
Well, that was a very happy job, but had some good consequences and some were indifferent. The first commission succeeded very largely. It got something like 70% of its recommendations adopted, and there were savings of $4 or $5 billion in the government, which were eaten up by the Korean War. But nevertheless, the second commission recommendations didn't fare as well in the hands of the Congress. I suppose we got through 30 or 40% of them.
Mr. Considine.
Mr. President, you spoke of the great relief work of some years back. Russia, of course, was a leading beneficiary of your wonderful work in that line. Dick Wilson and I came back recently from Moscow, and while there, one of the 150 books thrown out of the American exhibition was your book on Wilson. And I wonder if you had any comments as a deposed author.
I think they were right about it. If they want to suppress real sound opinions of the communist government and life, they ought to read Woodrow Wilson. He was about as strong on the subject as anybody we've ever had.
We had at the same time, from all sides, pleas from Russian leaders for more trade. And the thought was raised, Mr. President, that if we do trade, if we send some great heavy piece of, a single piece of machinery, let's say, that they don't have, they'll order simply one and then reproduce it. Is that an obstacle, do you think, in our trade with the Soviet Union?
Well, I think it is. It places us in a very difficult position. Our manufacturers, who the object of trade is to stimulate production in the United States, give more jobs to workmen. If we're going to give away one machine and no more, doesn't seem to me we get anything out of it. As a matter of fact, the whole question of trade with Russia has been vastly exaggerated. At no time, even in the time of freest of trade in our history, did we do more than $160 million worth of trade with Russia. That would be about what we're doing with Liberia at the present moment.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. President, you spoke in your statement earlier of the challenge of the Soviet Union. Some of us have been strongly impressed by that challenge and by the competition that the Soviet Union offers to the United States. I would like to ask you if you think that we are working hard enough in this country and if we have enough determination and will to stand against the Soviet Union.
Well, my feeling is that we have involved ourselves in too many crises and that our major job today is to clean up our own household, that we are in more imminent dangers from internal causes than we are from the Cold War.
Which causes are you referring to, sir?
Well, we're fast drifting into inflation, unbalanced budgets, overspending by Congress, the huge growth of crime. I don't know, there are half a dozen different things that infest the public mind with worry, anxiety, that need to be cleaned up at home.
Have these things weakened us so much that we can't stand out strong against Russia?
No, I wouldn't want anybody to think for a moment that the American people are not capable of solving any crisis. As a matter of fact, this nation is now in its 183rd year, and it has lasted longer than any representative government. It has gone through 7 wars. It has gone through 3 great depressions. It's had some bad administrations in Washington. It's fallen on evil days in every one of the wars which we've fought, which produced a series of crises. And yet, After all that, we still have of the original heritage, the American people, a very large part of what the forefathers established. We still have a freedom of religion, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of enterprise within the limits of some socialist attack, freedom of speech within the limits of a very mild laws on the subject. Generally, we possess today the same vitality, the genius, the initiative, and the ability to solve these crises that we have in the past. We need to be more diligent on the job.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Hoover, along those lines, you made a speech last year, and this is what you said. Let me stress at once that there is no expenditure, no tax burden, no austerity that we cannot endure in order to protect the United States from the greatest enemy of mankind in all human history. Those were your words. Are you satisfied that we are today making the necessary sacrifices?
I think so. I have great confidence in the genius of our military forces. I think they're moving into a complete set of defense. Now, I wouldn't include an offensive war, but I think they can defend the American people. We have one great difficulty in our competition with Russia that I think is greater than all others. And that is the lag in our training of the best brains we have in the United States, the creation of enough scientists and engineers to carry our productive system forward. The Russians are outnumbering us about 5-1 in those professions which we are solely dependent upon for our defense and for our progress and well-being.
What do you think we ought to do about that?
I think we ought to reorganize the high schools in the United States. Our technical institutions, I wouldn't be sure of these figures, but it turned out about 55,000 scientists and engineers in 1955, or they had that many in session. And I think this year they're likely to have less than 25,000. The Russians have got something like 85,000 right now. Well, if you'll make an inquiry amongst the institutions of higher technology, you'll find that their complaint is that the material that comes to them for entrance cannot pass their necessary requirements. They go right back to the high schools where we have a system which lacks entirely in discipline and in effective training of youngsters who have no ability to choose their own life when they're 13 years old.
Well, isn't that an indication that we are getting a little bit soft?
Well, I think we've got soft on the whole educational line. We've had a thing, I don't want to enter into a dispute, but we've had a thing around here called progressive education, by which youngsters are to elect what they would like to look at. I mean, naturally, they don't like to look at mathematics.
Mr. Huckley.
Mr. President, as I understand it, one of the primary purposes of farm subsidies and price supports is to keep the smaller farmer on the farm, even though we are told, and there is some evidence, that the larger farms can produce food and fiber more efficiently. Now, I'd like to ask you, do you think it's worth it to subsidize this stay-on-the-farm program, or should we be subsidizing a get-off-the-farm program for the smaller farmer?
No, I wouldn't be in favor of the latter. I think we've got to keep the small farmer on the farm. He's a very fundamental and stable factor of American life. On the other hand, there's only one way to meet a surplus production, and that is to, by force, reduce production itself. And we haven't been willing to resort to the necessary force to get a diversified agriculture. We've subsidized one crop, especially. The result is we're just drowned in it, huh?
Is it true, do you think, that sometimes these surpluses of ours could be a strength rather than a weakness?
Well, that depends on how much they are, because they don't—they're all perishable. Maybe turned over and kept for a few years in the shape of grain. On the other hand, one of my suggestions has been constantly that we look over the world and find what the caloric intake of nations are, and if any of them are below the necessary level of public health, that we just say to them, send your ships over here and we'll fill them.
Mr. Considine.
Mr. President, you spoke of the eternal verities of our great system, and very eloquently, too. But in peacetime, have you ever noticed as much of a change as we've undergone in our foreign policy, in our relations toward Russia and the Iron Curtain countries, in the past year or two? For example, we have the Vice President praising Mr. Gomulka of Poland as a great statesman. We have the leader of the great communist intrigue coming here, and we're all looking forward to his visit. 4 or 5 years ago, I think the architects of any such proposal might have been called before the McCarthy Committee. Haven't you noticed a great lessening of tension between the two great powers in that respect?
I shouldn't think the fundamental tensions are very much relieved. I do think that the president is a man who's willing to explore any channel to get peace. I don't think he's going to find it out of the Russian prime minister. And so far as some of these matters you mentioned concerned, I think they're rather superficial. When our officials go back and forth, we have to be nice and complimentary and kind.
Do you think that it means Our congratulatory messages to the likes of, let's say, Gomulka, do you think that means that we no longer extend the thought of liberation to the 100 million people of Eastern Europe?
No, I think the American people are very deep in their sympathies and very hopeful that the day will come when they're free. I don't believe we're prepared to surrender that for a minute.
But we wouldn't help them by any... We wouldn't help another Hungarian uprising, let's say.
Well, I can't answer that. You're talking about the action of a people and the people and the Congress. I'd be in favor of it, if that's what you want to know.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. President, what do you think will be the big political issue in 1960?
Well, you're getting into a field now that I've been trying to do my best for the last 3 years to get out of. So I'm not a candidate. You can take that as positive. And I'm not going to go into politics anymore. I'm too busy writing books.
How about the issues in 1960? Do you have any convictions on what it might be?
No, I think there are three or four of them that I'd like to see revived. This whole question of inflation. And also, I have pretty strong feelings about the treatment of Lewis Strauss.
Do you think it was... What do you think motivated the rejection of your former secretary?
Well, he was accused of being arrogant and secretive, and I don't know what all. That seemed to be the final charge in the last debate. But it's a curious thing. I think you might find it worth looking into. The membership of the Joint Commission on Atomic Energy of the Congress. I think you'll find the majority of them who were present at all of that supposed arrogance and secretiveness voted for the confirmation of Admiral Strauss.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. President, this is a semi-political question. The Republican Party has, in recent years, become the minority party. Do you expect them to once again become the majority party?
Well, being a long-time Republican, I'm always in hopes.
Have you any suggestions as to how they might become a majority party again?
No, I don't think it's up to me to be providing them with any advice. They seem to have a lot of committees going already.
Mr. Huntley.
Mr. President, I know you're very proud of the Hoover War Memorial Library on the campus at Stanford University in California. Now, going back to the beginning of that, did you find a large collection of that material in Europe at the time of World War I, or was it put together just bit by bit?
It put together bit by bit, but I had the ardent assistance of all of the men who were working under me in Europe for a period of 20 years when I was engaged in those activities. And there were probably 50,000 of those men over the world. And they all took part in collecting that material.
And is it the largest collection in the world on the period of the Bolshevik and Kerensky Revolution?
Far and away the largest and almost unique, because both the French and the German war libraries were destroyed in the Second World War, and the British Museum, which contained part of their records, also suffered. So today, literally hundreds of foreign historians have to come to the library at Stanford. Find out what's going on.
Mr. Considine.
I've got a good question, Mr. President. On the eve of your 85th birthday, how do you feel?
I feel physically perfect.
Good.
About 68, I think.
Good.
Mr. Wilson.
I will not be dissuaded from these political questions, Mr. President. You're interested in the Republican presidential nomination, I assume. Do you choose Nixon or Rockefeller?
That I will count out on this occasion.
Well, Mr. Hoover, I think our time's about up. Perhaps when you pay us a visit again, you'll have the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I'm very sorry, but I must interrupt. Thank you very much, Mr. Hoover, for being with us, and a very happy birthday from all of us.
And Monitor's thanks to former President Herbert Hoover, and birthday congratulations. And thanks to the members of the panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour, Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence Spivak. From Washington comes this announcement. The United States Information Agency, as part of its program to tell the world about America, is distributing books to foreign lands. If you have books you've enjoyed, why not donate them to the new Books from America program? By sending a book overseas, you not only help someone who wants to know more about life in the U.S., you're also helping to combat the wave of anti-American books being distributed by communists throughout the world. What books are most wanted in other countries? Mostly American literary classics, books by Mark Twain, James Fenimore Cooper, and Ernest Hemingway, or recent American history books. If you have such a book to share, that you've read and enjoyed it, wrap it and mail it at the low book rate to Books from America, Box 1690, Washington 13, D.C. Books from America, Box 1690, Washington 13, D.C. Well, this is Sunday evening, and since you can't run right down to the post office with an armload of books, the best thing to do is continue relaxing with Monitor. I'll join the listeners till next week when it's time again to occupy this communicator's chair. Till then, this is Ben Grauer saying good night.
This is NBC.
Driving?
Drowsy?
Stay awake, take no dose.
It could save your life.
No dose tablets.